Will plummeting oil prices stall Canada's economic rebound? The finance minister on how low they can go before our economy suffers. Plus, under fire in the House of Commons over the treatment of Canada's veterans.
So, will the minister for once do the honorable thing and resign?
Will the minister simply stop the travesty and resign?
Will the prime minister finally just show him the door?
But the Minister of Veterans Affairs has no plans to step aside.
Mr. Speaker, we are making substantial improvements. They're generating better outcomes for Canadian veterans, and that work is continuing, Mr. Speaker, and I'm proud to be part of that team.
Veteran Mark Campbell is also fighting the minister. Major Campbell lost both legs in Afghanistan, and he's one of seven plaintiffs who sued the government for changes to the Veterans Charter. A lower court had cleared the way for the lawsuit to go ahead, but the feds have challenged that decision. The former soldiers are upset over a new pension regime which pays a lump sum to wounded warriors rather than the gradual lifetime payments, which are, in virtually all long-term cases, more substantial. Joining me now, Major Mark Campbell. So you served your country, you lost both legs. There have been problems in terms of the family dealing with all of these issues. So how does it feel when you hear the government say that its promise to take care of you was all political talk and was not intended as a solemn commitment to soldiers wounded in battle?
Well, you know, my initial reaction is to be angry and to be deeply insulted. But really, what it all boils down to, when everything else sort of washes away, what's left is a terrible, heartbreaking feeling of abject betrayal by the government of Canada. I served 33 years loyally, I think, and in a steadfast manner, overseas four times, serving my country over 2 years away from my family overseas, not to mention all the training before and afterwards. And at the end of the day, you know, I did all that on a promise right from the recruiting office all through my career, including me telling my subordinate soldiers, don't worry, if you get hurt, you know, the system has your back, because that was the promise. And it all turned out to be a lie, a horrible, horrible, ugly lie.
Can you live on a lump sum payment like the government says?
There's no way you can live on even the maximum of, you know, just under $300,000 these days. I received just over $250,000 back in 2008. You can't live off of that. You can invest that all you want, even at 5%. You know, that's not enough to live on. You'd be well below the low-income cutoff for poverty. And I know people that did invest their money, and depending on when they invested it, they lost it all in the stock readjustment there back in 2009, thereabouts, 2009, 2010. So people lost their entire nest egg. My nest egg, it didn't even buy the lot that I had to buy in order to build a wheelchair-accessible home for myself and my family, carrying two mortgages, eating ramen noodles, and doing that whole gig for a year and a half.
So Mr. Campbell, even as veterans complain about not getting the benefits you need, we hear that Veterans Affairs returned over $1 billion to the Treasury it didn't spend, and we now know that some veterans managers got big bonuses for making cuts to veterans. How does it make you feel as somebody who's been wounded in action?
Well, I mean, how do you think it makes me feel? It makes me angry. It makes me resentful of a government. I mean, clearly Veterans Affairs, the department itself, and I'm not blaming any minister in particular, but I'm blaming the bureaucrats, the senior bureaucrats, the mandarins that don't change when government changes. They've run that department into the ground. They have turned the Department of Veterans Affairs into an adversarial friggin' insurance company, is basically what it is, and it's trying to nickel and dime veterans for every dollar it can get. And it seems to be, for some reason, picking on our new generation, our newest generation of disabled veterans, most of which come from the conflict in Afghanistan. I mean, the new legislation came in 2006. What was wrong with the Pension Act? Why did the Pension Act go away? I mean, they say that the new Veterans Charter brought in a whole new suite of assistance and benefits, services, you know, resume writing and job finding skills. Those are all wonderful, but they could have been added onto the Pension Act. Why did the Pension Act have to go away? And I'll tell you why. Because pensions cost a lot of money. If you can wash your hands of me for $250,000 and walk away, that's a heck of a cost savings. And to see that there has been financial mismanagement at Veterans Affairs to the tune of $1 billion, it's an outrage, and Canadians ought to be outraged. Here they are nickel-diming us, and in the meantime, they're sitting on $1 billion, and they're giving the senior bureaucrats, the very people who are the problem, the architects of this friggin' odious new veterans charter, they're the ones that are giving themselves fat cat bonuses. How does that sit with you as a taxpayer?
Well, Mr. Campbell, thank you for talking to us, and I hope that the minister and the prime minister will be listening to what you have to say. Thank you.
Well, I sure do hope they are too. And thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And to all Canadians, thank you very much for your time and attention to this matter.
We'll have more on this in a moment with our MPs and another controversy too.
Will the prime minister tell his minister to put down the newspaper and start doing her job?
Will the minister just put down her newspaper and do something for Northerners unable to feed their families?
Minister Gluka under attack after reading a newspaper in the House on Monday during questions about a government price subsidy program called Nutrition North. After a recent documentary showed people in Rankin Inlet, the minister's riding, scavenging for food at the local dump. The prime minister defended his minister.
Mr. Speaker, there is no doubt that the people of Nunavut have ever had stronger representation.
We did ask Minister Gluka and Minister Fantino to join us on the program today, but we did not receive a reply. So to discuss this, I'm joined by our panel of MPs, the very brave Aaron O'Toole from the Conservatives, Murray Rankin from the NDP, and Roger Cusner from the Liberals. So, Mr. O'Toole, why is it that Mr. Fantino never seems to want to do interviews? Is it because he's afraid to make us defend his actions, or is it the fact that the Prime Minister's office doesn't want him out and about?
No, I think he's focused on really what is the core of the Veterans Affairs Ministry, which is delivering services and improving the services. You know, we talked about mental health in the wake of the Auditor General's report. And Bob, there was virtually nothing for veterans in the early 2000s. There was 4 clinics opened by the last Liberal government, but virtually very little spending in Canadian Forces or Veterans Affairs on mental health. We've ramped that up dramatically. A lot of the ramp up, the new clinics and things like that, have been directly at Minister Fantino's direction. So has the review of the new Veterans Charter.
The Prime Minister has had to send in a former top general, Mr. Netinchuk, to become deputy minister. He's brought in from the Prime Minister's office a top aide, Stephen Lecce, to be the chief of staff. It doesn't look to me, Mr. Rankin, like the Prime Minister has an awful lot of confidence in Mr. Fantino.
It's unbelievable that he's still there. Both opposition leaders, of course, called for him to just resign. This is a scandal. It's just unbelievable. They let a $1.1 billion lapse in the budget. They've let 1,000 people go. They give bonuses to people for cutting services. They cut all these veteran centers. And a damning Auditor General report comes down. And where is he in Italy? I mean, they do a Mickey Mouse announcement, you know, which they later had to retract. $30 million over 6 years, we discover, is over 50 years. This minister's record is shameful.
But, Roger, you've been around long enough. When the Prime Minister is circling the wagons like that, he's probably not going to make Mr. Fantino walk the plank until after the election.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see much response here. The Prime Minister will, you know, as much as veterans are frustrated with this minister, as much as they feel they've been hoodwinked by this minister, I don't think you're going to see the Prime Minister react to the calls for his resignation. We'll continue to call for his resignation. And as far as the mental health stuff, our veterans are in a much different situation now than when the Liberals were in government in the early 2000s, establishing 4 mental health centers. We've got more veterans coming back from theater now, experiencing these problems, these mental, emotional problems. And so it's incumbent on the government of the day to do what they can to...
Let me ask Mr. O'Toole this, because you've served honorably in the Canadian Armed Forces. How do you feel about the fact that you have veterans who've lost their limbs in Afghanistan and they're fighting with the government before the courts to get better pensions than the lump sum ones that your government has put forward, and your government is fighting them in court?
Well, Bob, you know, I saw Major Campbell this week, who served the country with profound distinction, and I hate seeing any veteran frustrated with their government of any stripe on these issues. The reality of the new Veterans Charter, which I said before, was created by the Liberal government, and we're trying to make changes to it. Some of the changes to it were actually asked for by veterans groups, which is why all parties supported it. What we've seen is, as there's been serious injuries from the Afghanistan conflict, the new veterans charter hasn't been as flexible, hasn't been as positive. So we're making changes. A few years ago, we made changes by adding a supplement to the permanent impairment allowance. So the most seriously injured veterans, like Major Campbell, would not just get the lump sum. A lot of Canadians think that. They would get that. They would get the permanent impairment allowance, the supplement. The Ombudsman has said that has to be fixed because that drops off at 65. We're looking at fixing that. But there's actually a whole range of programs and treatments that veterans get.
Roger, I want to go on to another minister, Environment Minister, Leona Aguckak, who was in the House last week reading a newspaper where there was a raging debate about a food crisis in the north. I mean, it seemed to me that it was rather insensitive.
Well, regardless whether you're hiding behind a newspaper or hiding behind government talking points, she was on the wrong side of this issue right from the start. When you make that decision to protect your government rather than protect the people that you represent, I think you're on the wrong side of the decision. But, you know, let's make no mistake. They're not calling for more money. They're just saying, let's administer this program properly so that people get access to nutritious food.
I would just agree with that. I mean, the cost of food in the north remains ridiculously high, 8 times what it would be in the south. Yes, there's been more money given, a subsidy, but it's not getting to the people. The MPs from the north in our caucus say that that's the number one issue they get asked. And meanwhile, 50 to 100 people are foraging in the landfill in Rankin Inlet. And the minister says, what's her response? To sue. To go to court, threatening a lawsuit against the deputy mayor of that community. This isn't the kind of sensitivity we expect from a member of parliament. Forget the minister, just as a member of parliament. And then to read the newspaper as she does, I sit right across from her in the house, and these questions are raging, as you said, Bob, and she's hiding behind a newspaper. I was actually upset. I was shocked, actually.
So the government response, I mean, if you have people foraging in a dump because the food program isn't very good, and the minister then, or somebody in her office, called up the deputy mayor to scream at him because he is critical of this, it doesn't sound like she's very interested in this program and the people that are affected by it.
Bob, she's profoundly interested, and I'm appalled by this situation as well because of the conduct of the opposition. The reality is the Auditor General was looking at the problems with Nutrition North. It's a program we've done, and shipments of healthy food, it's about healthy food, are going up. We've got to fix the program, but it's there for a purpose. People, the reports of people at a dump, that's not about healthy food. That's people on the margins. And
well, that's a big problem that people are going to a dump.
It is. And with this minister, we have somebody who's from the area, has represented the area in territorial government.
But she brushed it off.
She's been in cabinet.
She brushed that off. She said it.
I was in the House, Bob. You know, we're trying to get more women, more visible minorities in Parliament. And I saw why she was reading the paper. She was frustrated and upset by the catcalls and the insults being hurled on a issue unrelated to the program. You know, this is the issue.
Wait a minute.
They're
misrepresenting
she said
that wasn't even
comments.
Happening. She says, oh, they just go to the dump to look for parts for their snowmobiles.
That's what she said. I mean, this program is broken. And that's what the Auditor General said. Yes, there's a subsidy. I agree and respect the government for making that subsidy. It's a crisis, the cost of food in the north. So good for the government. But are they monitoring the merchants? Obviously, if there's this subsidy and it still costs the same amount of food, it doesn't matter.
Let's improve the program, and we're committed to that. We've reinvested already. But let's not look at this. Politicians are human, Bob. You know, she has a profound passion for the North. There's never been a bigger champion. She's been in senior roles in cabinet, and I sit not far from her. And I was ashamed of the opposition and their conduct. Bringing in the dump, yelling things across the aisle. She was doing that with the paper because I could tell she was upset. There's nobody in the House that cares more about these issues. Most of these parties have not even been to Nunavut, Bob.
I've been to Nunavut, and let me tell you, as far as catcalls, you sit behind her. Murray and I sit across from her. She would be one of the most aggressive hecklers in the House of Commons, and I'm not picking on her at all. I'm just stating a fact. And what the most disappointing thing is that she dismissed the situation. All she had to do was say, there's problems, we are going to fix it, I'm going to be the minister, I'm one of you, I'm from that community, I am going to be your champion on this, and
you move on from there.
The North has never had a stronger voice. Than
all right, oh boy, hope that's true.
They said that about Peter Benashway.
We are in deep.
They said that about Peter Benashway.
All right, gentlemen, have a good Sunday. We'll have more on this with our scrum coming up later in the show. But first, with oil prices dropping fast, where does that leave the Canadian economy? The Minister of Finance, Joe Oliver, joins me next here on Question Period. Concerns over a slowing economy as oil prices have continued to plummet in recent weeks. But good news at the pumps for consumers.
The less expensive, the better.
Pretty amazing. It's pretty good. Good for the holidays.
It's a big difference, and at the end of the month, I'm saving like big money. I'm really happy on this.
But bad news for the oil industry here at home.
For every dollar that the price of oil comes down on a per barrel basis, the Alberta Treasury suffers a loss of $215 million.
Since July, crude oil has tanked from about $100 a barrel to below $70. The finance minister says there's no need to worry yet.
We're not at a price which will stop too many projects.
But on Thursday, Saudi Arabia cut crude prices further, prompting Canadian energy shares to nosedive and sparking new concerns for Canada's oil sector. And joining us now, the Minister of Finance, Joe Oliver. So, Mr. Oliver, it looks like Saudi Arabia is trying to wreck the North American energy market. Should Canadians panic?
Well, I don't think they're trying to do that. I think they're trying to protect their market share. The issue of volatile oil prices is, of course, significant for Canada because we're in a happy position of being able to export a lot of our energy. We have a lot more than we could possibly use. And so there are a variety of implications to that. I mean, on the positive side, of course, lower prices at the pump and lower energy costs for manufacturers. On the negative side, oil companies earn less money. There's less royalty for provinces and less corporate taxes for provincial and federal governments. So it does impact our fiscal framework.
So what's the net impact, say, on growth prospects and jobs if oil prices were to stay like this for a period of time?
Well, it's a very complex issue. We see the manufacturing sector in Ontario benefiting from this, and that will generate employment. So I can't give you an employment number. We're looking at it. We're monitoring it, and of course, because of the volatility, we don't know where precisely it will settle. But we took it into account in the economic and fiscal outlook.
So you're not going to see a situation where you might have to roll back some spending, particularly, say, for infrastructure projects, which may be easier to do because of loss of revenue?
No, we don't see any need to do that at all. There were some significant tax and family benefit programs that will benefit 4 million Canadian families, every one of them in fact, and a significant benefit to small businesses. 780,000 businesses will benefit. That's in place. We're going to go ahead with that, and we can still look forward to a balanced budget next year. We're confident that we can get there.
To what extent can the falling dollar and that helps exporters, but the lower oil prices means consumers have more money to spend on gasoline. They may put more money in the economy. Does that sort of, in some ways, balance itself off so that if you have more consumers spending because oil and heating prices are down, that the economy actually it'll either even itself out or even perhaps grow more?
Well, it's a balancing factor for sure, because as you say, if less money has to be spent at the pump, people will either save the money or spend the money. So it's good for consumption or it's good for investment. So that is a balancing factor. And of course, as the dollar declines, the impact of a lower oil price is mitigated somewhat. So it's fairly complex.
Now, one of the things that the Bank of Canada governor has again expressed concern about is high debt levels, and the effect that could have on the housing sector. Are you satisfied that you don't have to take any additional steps to sort of cool off the housing market because of all of this debt?
Well, the first point is that net worth of Canadians has gone up since we got into office by about 45%. The average income has gone up by 10% for low-income families by 14%, and delinquency rates are down, actually. Now, we're monitoring this fairly carefully. There have been a whole series of steps taken to take the froth out of the real estate market, and we don't see any need for a major step. If there's something of a more minor nature, we'll decide whether that's appropriate, you know, based on the on our analysis of the situation.
Now, the U.S. economy seems to be growing pretty well, actually, creating something like 300,000 jobs recently. We're obviously benefiting from that. Are we in a much better position than other countries because we're next door to the United States and most of our trade grows there?
That is, of course, a significant benefit. Look, we have the biggest bilateral commercial relationship in the entire world by far, $2 billion of trade every single day. And that's important because the international financial and economic situation overall is pretty fragile. I mean, Europe is almost flat and inflation is very low. There's a danger of a deflationary spiral in a $17 trillion economy, the biggest in the world. China's down from 10 to 7%. So all that's affecting Canada as a big trading nation. But as you say, our biggest relationship is with the United States, and it looks like their growth is sustainable. Not necessarily at rates that they were before the recession, but nevertheless, you know, getting fairly robust. And that's good for Canada, it's good for Canadian jobs. And I think it will start to liberate the cash that a lot of businesses are sitting on, because they, you know, need to know that exports will have a home, and it's starting to look like they will south of the border.
Speaking of south of the border, I know on Friday you met with Governor Christie from New Jersey, right. Was here in Ottawa. Do you get the sense he's going to run for president?
I think, look, he'll announce, but I think there's a good chance. He's a very personable guy, and in terms of Canada, he really wants to enhance the bilateral trade relationship. He's a great a proponent of the Keystone XL pipeline, and I think he's going to be a friend going forward.
All right, Minister, thank you very much for coming in. Appreciate it.
Most welcome.
For more on the effects of plummeting oil prices, we're joined by Craig Alexander, Senior Vice President and Chief Economist at TD Bank, and Jim Stanford, Chief Economist at Canada's biggest union, Unifor. So, Mr. Alexander, first question to you. The Bank of Canada governor says a broad and sustained recovery may finally be at hand. How can that be when we are seeing plummeting oil prices that could wreck the oil sector and that has kept the Canadian economy humming? I mean, the loss of revenues to the richest provinces could be huge.
Well, I think that what the governor is basically picking up on is the most recent quarter of economic growth came in above the Bank of Canada's expectations. We actually had growth in the quarter of 2.8%, and that was quite a solid performance. But he did flag the risks to the economy going forward of lower oil prices. I think one of the things that's softening the assessment by the Bank of Canada is the fact that we are seeing better momentum in the United States, and the U.S. economy is our major trading partner. I also think that with the drop in oil prices and gasoline prices that we've seen, this could be a real boost to U.S. consumer spending, and that can have a knock-on effect in terms of Canada's export sector. So I think the real issue here is that when oil prices drop, it creates winners and losers in the economy. I think on net, it's a negative for the Canadian economy, but not an extreme negative. In other words, it'll bring down growth projections for next year by a couple of tenths of a point, but it's not going to be a game changer in terms of the outlook that the Canadian economy is going to continue to grow at least a moderate pace.
Well, we talk about losers, Mr. Stanford. You know, in June, oil was $105 a barrel. It's now below $69. And the CEO of Canadian Resources says it could fall as low as $30. This has got to be bad news for your Unifor members who work in the oil fields.
Well, we do have members who work in oil sands production, but for the operations that are there now in business, Bob, I don't expect much of a negative impact at all. Remember, these operations, like at Suncor, for example, have already been built. They're operating. The oil price would have to fall to close to zero before they actually shut those plants. What's actually going to be affected is the major new expansion plans that are on the books. That's where all of the companies are going to be looking at the price. How long is it going to stay low? And then they'll look at putting off some of those big new investments. But for our members who are actually working there today, I don't see much of a risk that they're going to lose their jobs in the near future. What we will see is a bit of a cooling off of the whole sort of oil boom mentality. And I think that is the answer to the sort of quandary that you posed at the beginning. How can the whole economy be doing better than expected when the oil price is coming down? And I think that's proof positive that the oil industry is not actually as central to our national prosperity as some of the rhetoric would have you believe. Yes, it is an important part of it, but Canada is not a petro economy. We're a very diversified mixture of different industries, and this downturn in the price of one sector's output is not going to drag down the whole economy.
Well, some people would argue with you on that, Mr. Sanford. Many people think that our dollar is a petrodollar. So, Mr. Alexander, when oil prices go down, so does our dollar. Doesn't this help us sell our goods to the U.S. economy?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different effects happening. So the first one is that while oil prices have tumbled and come down a long way in a relatively short period of time, the Canadian dollar has also fallen, and that's acting as a shock absorber for a lot of the oil producers because they sell in U.S. dollars. And so when they bring the money back into Canada and price it in Canadian dollars, the drop in the exchange rate is making the impact, you know, less acute. The second thing that's been happening is that we've seen, you know, in past years, a very large discount on Canadian oil. Like Canadian oil producers were receiving prices that were dramatically lower than the world benchmark price. And what's happened is when the oil prices have fallen, we've also seen the discount that the Albertan, for example, producers are receiving. That discount has diminished. So the combination of a falling Canadian dollar combined with the narrowing of the discount is actually meaning that the impact on producers is less than what the headline number would look like. But it has very big regional effects. So what you're really going to see is the outperformance of oil-rich provinces like Alberta relative to the rest of the country is going to diminish sharply.
Mr. Sanford, one of the things that we've seen over the last decades for Ontario has been a dark period of time for Ontario manufacturers that have been hurt by the high dollar and having to pay higher oil prices. This could be a significant boon to the Ontario manufacturing sector if the dollar's low and if they're paying less for energy when they try to sell their goods abroad.
I think that's true to some extent, Bob. Another way that it could benefit our manufacturing and other exports is through the U.S. economy. As Craig mentioned, the U.S. is our biggest customer for exports, and the U.S. is a net oil importer. So the net impact on GDP of lower oil prices is clearly positive in the U.S. case. So that's where we get an indirect benefit through the benefits for our biggest trading partner. So the dollar is the main one. The fact that we did allow the dollar to go up to par, far over its fundamental value, and stay there for several years was just a huge weight around the shoulders of anyone trying to sell anything other than oil from Canada into the world economy. So it's still too high relative to its true value. It needs to come down a few more cents, but even the decline that's been experienced so far is going to be good, not just for manufacturing, but for exports of services, for our tourism industry, like I say, for any industry other than oil that we sell into world markets.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for your insights. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Bob.
It's been a pleasure, Bob.
Can infighting be put aside as the Assembly of First Nations elects a new leader this week? That's coming up next on Question Period. Make sure to vote in our year-end poll. Help us pick the top three stories of the year and tune in December 28th to see the results. Canada's Assembly of First Nations is voting for a new national chief this week. Former leader Sean Attlio stepped down in May after chiefs across the country decried his decision to support the government's education bill. There are three people in the race: Ghislaine Picard, who has been the interim leader since Attlio resigned; Perry Bellegarde, head of the Federation of Saskatchewan Chiefs; and Leon Jardin, chief of Ontario's Lac-Roi First Nation. For more on the race and what it means, I'm joined by Jorge Barrera from the Aboriginal Peoples Television Network and James Nikon Sinclair from the University of Manitoba. So, first question to you, Jorge. It looks like this is down to a two-man race, east and west, between Ghislaine Picard and Perry Bellegarde. Is that correct?
That's what I've been hearing. And I spoke with Noel Starblanket today, who was the AFN National Chief and Indian Brotherhood Chief. He was in the transition period between 76 and 1980. And I spoke to him about, you know, what's going on? What are you hearing? And he told me that he believes that Bellegarde has the edge going into Winnipeg. He said that Bellegarde hasn't stopped campaigning, that Bellegarde has made some serious inroads into BC, which is an important province because it has about one-third of all First Nations in the country. And also you got Ontario. Ontario is expected to maybe park their votes with Leon Jourdain on the first ballot, and then they'll break off, you know, in preceding ballots depending on where the wind's blowing. But it looks like Bellegarde has the edge going in.
So, Mr. Sinclair, either of these two men, do they have what it takes to change the face of the Assembly of First Nations?
The one really interesting thing is you describe this as an east-west debate. I see this as a economic agenda versus a sort of Matthew Kuhn-come-like agenda from Ghislaine Picard. So Perry Bellegarde's been riding on the economic agenda. And so in many ways, that is what's opened up the gateway for him to have support in British Columbia. The really interesting thing, I think, that Jorge has pointed out is where does Ontario go? Because Ontario is probably going to support Joinette at the start. But then if they turn, because there's a real power right now to come towards a rejectionist kind of agenda, particularly with this federal government. And Ghislaine has picked up the energy on that. So do they have either one of them? I think either one of them presented option of dealing with the federal government, that both of which, one is an agenda that goes with the federal government, but against much of the grassroots of the Idle No More movement, which created kind of an irrelevancy of the Assembly of First Nations at the moment. And then Ghislaine Picard, who is going to really feed into much of the energy of the grassroots, but probably will get very little done, as Matthew Kuhn-come didn't either.
So, well, that's interesting, because I always thought that Picard was less confrontational than Bellegarde would be.
Picard is confrontational when he has to be, but both Bellegarde and Picard are seasoned politicians, right? I mean, Picard has been the regional chief for the AFNLQ since about 92, and he's also made himself heard amid the Quebec political din. I mean, Couillard met with First Nations chiefs after he won the Quebec election, so he knows how to get his voice out there and get his voice heard. But like Bellegarde, they both have been around, the game for a long time and know politics and know how to, how to compromise.
But here's the point you've picked up, and I want to ask you this, Mr. Sinclair. These are old-style politicians. They've been around a long time. Where is the new, young, dynamic, native leaders? We don't see them, and I would have thought after Idle No More, you would have seen more people want to come forward to run for the leadership of the Assembly of First Nations.
Well, no, I do think you see more energetic First Nations leader than ever before. I'm thinking of Chief Isidore Day, Chief Arlen Dumas, Chief Derek Nepinak, dozens of other chiefs, both in British Columbia and Ontario. But most of these leaders see little to no availability to get much work done, both with this federal government and in terms of an advocacy organization by the Assembly of First Nation. The AFN as a whole has shifted gradually over the past 10, 15 years towards an approach that's been very dependent on federal government funding and less on project funding as it had in the past. And as a result, it's really walked itself into irrelevancy, as we saw during the Idle No More movement, when all of the grassroots, including many chiefs, were standing outside asking Chief Atlio not to meet with the federal government because they didn't see any availability in that. Until the AFN really walks itself further into redundancy, and then breaks off perhaps altogether from federal government funding, starts looking at options to create itself autonomously, then maybe you would see an independent, younger, energetic leader, female or male, to come along the way and perhaps save the organization. But at the moment, it's a very lose-lose situation for anyone with political aspirations.
So do you agree that the AFN is in trouble, that they can't seem to get more dynamic leaders?
I think it gets a little bit even beyond like leaders, right? Like the AFN technically is not about the leader, right? It's about just chiefs and assembly who tell the leader what to do. The leader's supposed to sort of transmit and represent and reflect the sort of collective position of First Nations leaders across the country, band chiefs in particular. Right now, I think the biggest issue that the AFN has is trying to paper over some of the fractures that it went through because of the Education Act situation. There was a lot of bad blood that flowed over, throughout that. So I think one of the most important tasks the next leader has to do is to try to hold this thing together. And that's why maybe you have these sort of old school politicians are the ones who've surfaced, because maybe people, because remember, it's only chiefs that vote for this. And maybe the chiefs are thinking, well, the only way we can make this thing survive is for these old school guys who know the game to keep this thing together.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Much appreciated. And coming up, the scrum weighs in on the opposition's call for the Veterans Affairs Minister to resign. That's coming up next on Question Period. And welcome to the scrum with the usual suspects. Gloria Galloway from the Globe and Mail, John Iveson from the National Post, Tana McCharles from the Toronto Star, and of course the great Mr. Oliver. So first question to you, Craig. Julian Fantino was a top-notch police officer. He ran a number of police forces. Since he's come to Ottawa, he's had a rough time in almost every portfolio that he's had, but nothing worse than Veterans Affairs, where one would think that he would have had more affinity with the veterans.
Well, I don't know why anyone would really think that, because his skill set as a policeman was he was seen as an enforcer. He was not a believer, really, in measured police work. He failed at CDA. He didn't do well at defense when he was trying to look after the F-35s. That was a mess. So people were astonished when a person with his kind of lack of sensitivity and needs empathy, Veterans Affairs, when the Prime Minister put him in that job. It just wasn't his kind of thing. He looks like a bouncer on Saturday night in Sudbury at a strip club. And he is just not the kind of guy that really can sit down, have a beer, put his arm around some soldier who's having a problem or two and talk about it. But his biggest problem is, and this is the Prime Minister's problem too, that what the vets are hating most about the policy at Veterans Affairs and all of the mistakes and misconceptions we've heard about this week are all Harper government policy. So what he's got to defend doesn't help either.
Gloria, you've written an awful lot on this. Is this all being driven from the Prime Minister's office, or is Fantino largely at fault here?
Well, you know, I honestly don't think that Mr. Fantino is necessary to blame for everything that's gone wrong here. I mean, the whole thing started, well, started a long time ago, frankly, but the most recent spate of troubles started with their big announcement of $200 million over 6 years, which turned out to be not over 6 years at all, but over decades into the future. I don't think Mr. Fantino wrote those talking points. I don't think he devised the communications news releases that had the incorrect information in it. I think he just went out and read the script in that case, and of course all heck lands on his head for it. And you know, I don't think he was necessarily the one who can be blamed for the cuts to his department. Those are government-wide cuts that have been made.
But there is a realization that this guy is troubled, because they brought in, you know, former Chief of the Defense Staff Walt Natinchuk to be the Deputy Minister, and just last week Stephen Lecce, who was a top guy in the Prime Minister's office, gone in as Chief of Staff.
This should be a no-brainer portfolio. You should just be able to go in there, be kind to vets, give them what they want, appear in photo ops, go around and commemorate the previous glorified battles of Canada, and yet they've botched it so incredibly, it makes you shake your head.
But nobody should convince themselves that he's done anything that the government thinks is a firing offense. The government and the Prime Minister still has confidence in him, and even the Prime Minister came to his rescue somewhat in Question Period this week by saying that $200 million isn't over 50 years, it's actually over the 6 years we said, and going out through 50, if those people need help from this program, there will be money to fund this program. So when you've got your Prime Minister doing your damage control, yes, you've made a huge political mess of a file.
I don't think Stephen Harper, for all his reputation of being a hard guy, likes firing people. He doesn't particularly like that confrontation. If you look through the history of the government, there have only been really three out-and-out executions, Maxime Bernier, Elena Georges, and Bev Oda.
it's not the confrontation he doesn't like. It's the embarrassment he doesn't
like.
Well,
I think it creates a whole dynamic which he then has to, you know, you have to fill the spot, and there's a knock-on effect and all these things. Yeah. I don't think it's going to happen, and the people I talk to don't think it's going to happen either.
Well, speaking of embarrassments, what about Leona Aglukkaq, who is the environment minister, who hasn't done a particularly, hasn't shone in that portfolio, and then this whole issue of the food crisis in the north, and she was reading a newspaper.
This thing, I think, they play into the same area, and I think the government's had a very strong fall, and things are going relatively well for them, but their big enemy is this idea of arrogance. And she, reading a newspaper in the House of Commons, it doesn't really matter what she thinks about the opposition's questions. She obviously didn't think much of them. But she has to at least give the appearance of answering them, because that's what democracy is about. That's what our parliamentary system is about. And she's giving a sense that she's above that parliamentary system.
And they only have...
In the same way that Fantino, I think, has been given the sense that, well, he doesn't really need to deal with the vets who are his constituency.
It's astonishing that they only have 45 minutes a day in front of the public eye where they have to appear to be doing their job and answering to the electorate, to Canadians, via questions from the opposition. And yet this seems to be just trouble for ministers like her. I don't recall a strong moment she's had in the House. And yet, I think John's right again. You know, I don't think she's actually going anywhere anytime soon. They don't see that she's committed a firing offense again.
But not even to mention her failures on the environmental front.
That's really coming from the Prime Minister's office.
But she's carrying it, and she can't appear in front of any of us to defend their policy. And in a sense, that's Fantino's problem too, apart from his other issues with communication.
I was very surprised that they actually did send out Ms. Aglukkaq to talk to at least one news media outlet this week to defend her spat with
too bad she wouldn't talk to everybody. She usually runs away from the media.
Well, she has a history of that, but she did at least do one interview. I was very surprised to see her before the cameras, because we talked a lot about how she is so reticent to appear before us.
Okay, let's talk about another leader, the leader of the Liberal Party. He's finally appointed somebody to deal with this sexual harassment cases involving two members of his party, a lawyer, a human rights professor, I believe. Her name is Cynthia Peterson. What do you know about her, and what do you think this is going to go?
Well, she's got experience dealing with sexual harassment files. She's worked on them for the Law Society of Upper Canada, the regulating body for the Ontario lawyers. So she's got some experience in dealing with these. But her job isn't, I don't think, at the end of the day, to resolve the dispute between the NDP and the MP, Liberal MPs. It's to give Justin Trudeau a report card on whether or not he can justify his decision to kick them out of caucus summarily and to say they won't be candidates in the next election, as far as he's concerned.
He needs a way out. That's what Trudeau needs, and that's what he hopes he gets from this woman. I doubt that the women who feel aggrieved, the NDP women, are going to talk to her. I can't imagine they would. And I even wonder whether the Liberal MPs will talk to her, because they feel that they've been hung out to dry already, and that she might just be there to finish the job.
I mean, I'm surprised they actually found somebody to do this job, because we know that those NDP MPs are not going to talk to her. So they're going on notes that were taken in a meeting where the NDP MPs were present. I mean, the bar here is not beyond reasonable doubt, but there has to be some sense that of guilty or not guilty.
And I don't see how this is a way out at all. I mean, no matter what she comes up with, even if she comes up and says, you know, these guys didn't do anything, they're fine. Well, the NDP is just going to accuse them of creating a whitewash to the facts. I mean, the only way that this is going to work at all is if there's some backroom dealings between the NDP and the Liberals to say, okay, this is our way out. But I don't believe that's the case, and I think, you know,
it's a fig leaf, and this will give them the off-ramp that you need. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's switch to another subject. 17 Senate vacancies. The senators are complaining about how hard they're having to work and that they need these senators appointed, and the Prime Minister is saying, look, there's no rush by the public to fill these positions. Do you feel any sympathy, Craig, for these hard-working senators?
I actually did have couple of senators come to me and say, you know, we're all on four or five committees each. It's really been difficult. They're having such a hard time, and now they're harassing us about how many stamps we use when we send mail out. So it's hard to, it's not keeping me awake at night. I'm not crying in my beer over them, you know?
Although here's something that I found a little bit egregious, was that when Mr. Harper explained his reasoning for not appointing more senators, he said, well, you know, the Senate's passing all our bills right through anyway, so they're doing their job, so, you know, that's all we need done. Well, excuse me, but the job of the Senate is not to simply rubber stamp the bills from the House. Their job is actually to do some investigation. Right. And if they don't have a job beyond rubber stamping, well, that's a very expensive $100 million and $92 million rubber stamp.
Well, here's why I think actually people should care about it. I think that there are all kinds of bills that are being processed by Senate committees right now, and they're getting cursory looks at. They're getting witnesses coming up, popping up in and out for half an hour at a time, and over complex legislation. And I think that were those committees to be up to speed, have full resources, full staffing, people could be giving the legislative look at the bills that are coming through as they should. So yeah, I think that Canadians should care that the Senate is understaffed and not looking at the legislation in the way it
very,
does.
Right. Very punishing 25-hour week. It's there may be workplace health issues up there.
Okay, good point, John, and I'm sure you'd be willing to volunteer to sit in the upper chamber.
If I was asked, I might have to serve. I'm joking, folks. I'm joking.
Okay, I have to wrap this up. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week, and I'll be right back. Parliament will wrap this week for the Christmas break, but we'll be on the air throughout the holidays, so make sure to vote in our online poll to pick the top three stories of the year at cdbnews.ca/QP. You can watch the results on December 28th as our scrum counts down the top 10 stories of the year. And make sure to watch QP's Newsmakers of the Year January 4th, including one-on-one interviews with top politicians. And speaking of the holidays, Parliament Hill became rather festive on Wednesday night as the outside lights were lit for the season. We'll leave you with a look at that. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.